From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Count down the houses on your block. Pew Research says at least one in every three of them has a gun inside.
When I was a little girl, my father taught me how to shoot. I was 8 years old when he first put a gun in my hand.
I own them for hunting. I own them for protection. Matter of fact, I got one in the door of my truck. If somebody comes up right now and wants to start something, I'm putting them where they belong. It's quicker than calling the police.
I am a single woman who lives alone, and I need to be able to protect myself.
And I hope to God that I never, ever have to use it.
That was Duren Jordan from Douglasville, Georgia, Penny from Stone Mountain, Lee Lovelace of Ashland, Alabama, and Coco from Atlanta. This hour, a special program on guns in the South, the emotions they stir, how they're bought and sold, the total cost of gun violence, and the history of laws that control who has access to them. We'll even take a hunting trip. First, though, we recently talked about whether guns really make their owners safer.
Study after study has shown that if you have a gun in your home, the risk of someone in your family being shot goes up 200%. It triples.
That's Mark Rosenberg, former president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health. Here are your first thoughts.
My name is William Ryan. I'm calling from Peachtree City, Georgia. If you want to be safe in your person and property, get a gun, learn how to use it safely, and because the cops have no legal duty to protect you.
We love getting your thoughts and opinions and views. Call us, like William did, at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter, at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Before we get into an in-depth discussion of gun control and how this debate plays out in the South, let's catch up on current Georgia gun laws and how we became one of the most permissive states in the country when it comes to guns. It was not always this way. At one point, we led the nation in gun control.
The free person of color so detected in owning, using, or carrying firearms shall receive upon his bare back 39 lashes.
And that state law passed in 1833. Its motivation was racial.
Some of the earliest gun control legislation was, in fact, aimed directly at black people.
Robert Cottrell is a professor of law at George Washington University.
Immediately after the Civil War, the southern states in 1865 and 66 passed the Black Codes, and among other things, the Black Codes prohibited the newly freed black population from having weapons. In fact, that was one of the principal reasons for the passage of the 14th Amendment, was basically to attack the Black Codes and also to apply the Bill of Rights and specifically the Second Amendment to the states.
Gun control was first applied to white Georgians a few years later, in 1837. Lawmakers banned all concealed weapons. Peter Hoffer is a legal historian at the University of Georgia.
And what the authorities were afraid of is that people carrying concealed weapons, all of a sudden the threat appears and you didn't know it was there. Whereas if someone is carrying a weapon that's visible, you know that the threat is there.
But that concealed carry ban was short-lived. The Georgia Supreme Court struck it down in 1846.
A prohibition against bearing arms openly is in conflict with the Constitution and void.
This case is still cited in modern courts as a precedent. It's the first gun control measure in the nation overturned on Second Amendment grounds. Now Georgia's known as a shall-issue state. That means law enforcement agencies have to issue a concealed carry gun permit to anyone 21 or older who passes a background check. States where officials have more discretion are called may-issue states. In 2006, Georgia became a stand-your-ground state. That's a legal defense for shooting someone you think is a danger to you. The National Rifle Association even sells insurance policies to cover shooters who claim self-defense. These policies were heavily advertised at the group's annual convention in Atlanta this year.
We prepare for so much that leads up to pulling the trigger. Are you prepared to deal with what happens after?
In 2014, Governor Nathan Deal signed the Safe Carry Protection Act. It's also known as the Guns Everywhere Law. It allows people to carry guns into bars, churches, school zones, government buildings, and certain parts of airports. University campuses were added to the list over the summer when Georgia became the 10th state to enact a campus carry law. As of July, it's legal to have a concealed gun in most areas at a state school. Mandy Ballinger is a Republican representative from Canton who supports the measure.
It's really the God-given right that people have to not be a victim. States that have enacted campus carry or campus safety have become safer. The numbers prove that, and so we just want to afford that protection to all Georgians.
But most research does not show that guns make campuses safer. University of North Georgia professor Matthew Bodie recently looked at police records for two major universities in Utah, where campus carry has been around since 2004.
Police reported back zero incidents of anyone reporting to them that they had used a gun to stop a crime.
There's really no consensus on what can stop gun violence. We sent GPB reporters out all over the state to ask Georgians what they think might help. Here's Ashley Crumbly in Savannah.
I think they should, like, evaluate people first before they, like, let them get a license to carry a gun.
Me llamo Darío y vivo aquí en Rex. Por su seguridad, okay, está bien, es para su seguridad.
My name is Darío, in Rex, Georgia. It's okay if it's for their security, but make sure that's true, and they're in good psychological state in order to be able to have a gun. And if they're not, don't give it to them.
Many people told us they don't think there's anything you can do to prevent shootings.
Because you can't monitor every single person 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Rex Musgrove, I live in Tucker, Georgia. People that the kids and stuff that get shot is the parents, or that they're not responsible gun owners.
My name's Charlie Walters. I live in the woods. Gun control is not going to work. We take away all the guns, people start killing people with knives. We take all the knives away. People start killing everybody with forks. We take all the forks away. They start killing people with spoons.
Duran Jordan of Douglasville told us he carries a concealed handgun wherever he goes.
So I feel a little bit lost without it, especially if I'm traveling. I don't see the purpose in fully automatic weapons for anybody owning a weapon such as that, which is purely for mass destruction. I don't understand the point of having a gun that has 50 rounds of ammunition.
Weapons that fire continuously are banned in the U.S., but semi-automatic weapons can be modified to have the same effect. That's what happened in Las Vegas recently. In Georgia, no state law regulates the sale or possession of semi-automatic weapons. There's also nothing stopping people who are accused of domestic violence or subject to domestic violence protective orders from buying or possessing firearms. Federal law requires a dealer to run a background check before they sell you a gun, but in Georgia, those checks are not required if you have a concealed carry permit, and they don't apply to sales between individuals.
If you sell a gun to your buddy Jim, he does not have to go through the background check. He should, but he doesn't have to. That's one of the failings of the Georgia law.
Jim Richardson works behind the counter of a small gun store in Metro Atlanta.
If you come in with a carry permit, I don't have to do the background check. You can purchase the gun, put it in your car, and take it home.
Richardson says he usually runs a check anyway, unless it's a regular customer.
When you gauge someone when they come in, that's a gray area. It's almost like you have to profile them. You have to do your own, and it's not racial. It's not so much racial as moral and ethical.
He guesses that in the past year, he's encountered around 100 people who tried to buy guns but did not pass the background check. And he's refused to sell to two people, even though they met all the requirements. Georgia's season for hunting with firearms opened last Saturday. GPB's Emily Curitan met up with a father and son hunting deer together in the woods around Monroe County.
My name is Evan Mixon. I'm 16 years old. I live in Macon, Georgia, and we're here at the land that we hunt at and trying to kill a deer.
Van Mixon. I'm Evan's father. I live in Macon, Georgia.
I'm loading the gun. This is a 243 Winchester, and this is a hunting load. It's called a ballistic tip, and it expands when it hits something. So more devastating impact. This is his gun. It's a 308 Browning. Bolt action.
Very quiet right now, maybe. Try and go out of your way not to step on things that are going to make more noise. I'm going to go up first, and then I'm going to set the gun down because it's got a nice little prop up there. And then you can climb up. Okay. Ready when you are. I'm texting Evan. He's sitting about, I'd call that 25 feet away in the tripod stand. He's about the same level we are off the ground, which I'd say 15 to 18 feet. We're separated by a few small trees. But we can, you know, see parts of him. He can see parts of us. I'm just going to send him a text asking if he can hear us whispering. Oh, there's an owl. Oh, that's a nice one. He shot his first deer. We were in this stand together 2 years ago, and it walked out from that opening you see down there between the kudzu, and we watched it till it got right up in here, and I was talking to him just like this, you know, saying, you know where to aim, make sure you're steady, you know, don't jerk the trigger. And he did everything right. It fell right where I shot it there. And he actually shot it with the rifle that I shot my first deer with. You could say there's a supermarket right down the road. You don't have to do this. I'm like, what? I could counter with it. I'm taking this animal a lot more humanely than the caged animals are treated and slaughtered. And I'm not wasting it, you know. I can't give you a definitive right, wrong. I don't know that there is one, but I don't feel bad, no. Deer over here. There's a small deer over here behind my right shoulder. Keep looking, you'll see it. Behind us, it's walking directly behind us. It'll be off your left shoulder. It's a tiny, I would never shoot that deer. Afraid it just knew something was up. It looked right at me. You wouldn't think they could make their way through that kudzu, but I've seen they walk through there so effortlessly. I guess they have their lines, and it just looks like slicing through water. We're past legal hunting light right now, so yeah, I don't know if Evan's on his way down or not yet. He may be waiting to see us move.
So is it disappointing when you sit up there and there's nothing?
No, I mean, it happens. It's hunting, it's not shooting.
That was 16-year-old Evan Mixon of Macon, Georgia, and his father, Van Mixon. This year marks Evan's first season as a licensed hunter in Georgia. That piece was produced by GPB's Emily Curitan. To see pictures of their hunt, visit gpbnews.org. Just ahead, we continue this special hour of programming. Did you post about the mass shooting in Las Vegas on social media? We'll talk about how to share responsibly. First, though, the costs of gun violence. This is On Second Thought. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. All this hour, we're talking about gun violence in Georgia. For 29-year-old Anthony Mackey, guns were part of his growing up in Albany. As a teen, he joined a gang and saw firsthand the incredible power of a gun. Mackey says being shot at was a turning point.
My name is Anthony Mackey, and I live in Albany, Georgia. My upbringing was very poor. I seen a lot of gang violence, gun shooting. I know what it's like to be evicted out of household, not having a stable household, and just living from house to house. Sometimes I would just basically run away. By the time I was 12, I joined the gang. Basically, it's a group of people that was called the South Side Bloods. and what it was like. It was more so, to me, it was like more so of a family. It was somebody that you can hang out with, laugh and joke with. It was people that come on outside of town. We would go to school. We would get into fights in the bathroom, after school, skating rink. Just being young and ignorant. Go to different neighborhoods and pick fights. Jump on people, jump on crackheads in the middle of the night, 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, pretending like we're gonna rob a crackhead because we just didn't have anything to do. When I got shot, I was like between 16 and 17. Yeah, 16 and 17 in high school. I was basically in the neighborhood. I'd rather not call the neighborhood, but I was in a neighborhood on the south side of town, and we was walking down the street because that group of gang had jumped on one of our friends, and we found out where the guys was at, and we end up meeting like halfway, and we walking towards them, and they walking towards us, and all of a sudden they stopped. And they just started shooting at us. And we just took off running. All of us took off running. It's like you just never know when it may be your day to fight by yourself or get shot at or get jumped on. There's more so of a wake-up call due to running from bullets. You hear a bullet hit the stop sign that you're turning from. So thinking about it to this day, I probably wouldn't be in this studio talking to you if that bullet would have hit me, because it was actually beside my head. After the shooting, I decided to just fall back, not participate or be around the wrong crowd anymore. So my plan is to go into law enforcement only because I know what it's like to be unfortunate black man. Now, as I look on the news, I look on CNN, I see what Trump is doing, I see what certain officers are doing, I say the bad officers are doing to my race and my community. And instead of talking about it, I could at least be one black man that could step in and help and try to bridge the gap between the white and black race.
That story was produced by Sean Powers. Anthony Mackie continues to call Albany home with his wife and young daughter. Earlier this year, he earned his bachelor's degree and is working as a corrections officer at the Daugherty County Jail. As you probably have guessed, this is a full hour, a special hour on firearms in Georgia and the South, and we're collecting the comments that you have. From Milledgeville, here's Vincent Smith.
I think if we educate people that before you get a gun, maybe take people to a range and let them shoot. Short video on the violence, and people think, you know, once they have a gun that they're invincible, but that's not the case. I can have a gun and still get shot.
We invite your opinions as well. Reach us, call us at 404-500-9457 or find us on social media. It's difficult to study gun violence unless you can calculate the cost. And how do you calculate the cost of it when what's often lost is human life? According to health economist Ted Miller, the societal cost of gun violence in Georgia in 2012 was more than $9 billion. Miller's with the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, and he joins me from Washington, D.C. Good morning, Ted.
Good morning, Celeste.
So what are your line items when you're calculating the cost of gun violence? What do you have to measure?
You have to measure medical costs, the mental health care costs, the criminal justice costs, so the costs of police investigation, of courts, of prisons. You have to measure the lost wages, the lost quality of life, and the cost to your employer.
So let me play you this comment. 31-year-old Albert Davis in South Carolina was charged with murder. That's because he allegedly handed a gun to a 3-year-old boy, told him to chase another young man. The gun went off. It killed the young man. This is a comment from Dr. P. Alex Mabe. He's chief of psychology in the Department of Psychiatry and Health Behavior at Augusta University. And he's talking about what now happens, what that 3-year-old child now faces.
They will often have nightmares. They will have fearful reactions, anything that might remind them of these traumatic events. Often they're very vigilant, watching for, looking for danger. And so general stress reactions in a young child would be expected and would probably linger for a while.
How do you get at a cost for something like that? I mean, I assume it's included in mental health, but how do you calculate?
Frankly, we don't have good treatments for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. So I can't actually include the medical costs for treating PTSD. When I did a cost recently of the cost of the Las Vegas shooting, I was very clear that there were 22,000 people in that arena. They're probably, most of them are probably going to need mental health treatment costs. A lot of the people who worked in the hotel may need mental health treatment costs. We don't have a good way to know what those are.
And let me play you another comment, because gun violence is a particular problem in Savannah, Georgia. So this is the voice of Kim Dulick we're going to hear. She started a group called the Savannah Peace Initiative. And here's her comment on when she very first moved to Savannah.
Once we moved here, first thought fireworks were going off, and I thought, did they really celebrate that much in Savannah? Every night we're having fireworks. And one of the neighbors said, you know, those are gunshots. It is almost an every night occurrence. And I've even got some people that have reached out to me who suffer from PTSD because of the constant gunfire.
So she mentions PTSD, which you also said, you said we can't really calculate. But she's also talking about the effect on a community, is she not?
She certainly is. And again, that my estimates are the costs of the firearm injuries themselves. I have not done estimates of the costs of the to the communities. And one of the reasons for that is communities that have a lot of firearm assaults and homicides also have a lot of assaults that are not with a firearm, a lot of robberies that are not with a firearm. And there's no easy way to separate the effects of crime in general and of gun-related crime from one another that I know of.
Okay, so those are some of the things that we can't calculate. Let's go back to the things that we can. Tell me a little bit about how much we're spending on to treat gunshot wounds and gunshot victims.
We're spending about $4 billion a year to treat the firearm injuries. And the mental health care costs of, say, survivors when somebody's killed, because that murder puts some people into mental health treatment. We do have a bit of data on that.
And that's separate from the $4 billion that we spend for their actual medical care?
No, it's part of the $4 billion.
And has that gone up? Is there a trend either down or up?
It's fairly stable over time.
How I mean, over time, like a decade?
Yeah, there was a period where there was a lot of drug-related violence going on, where firearm injury peaked because of the things that were happening with the gun with the drug trade on the streets. And it's come down from there, but it's been stable for quite some time now. And it's worth noting that in 1970, 1980, 1990, more than half of American households owned a gun. That's down to 40% of American households.
But also many households own multiple guns, meaning that the number of guns owned has gone up at times, correct?
That's right. And right now, the average household that owns guns has almost 8 guns. We have more guns than we have cars in this country. We have more guns than we have people in this country.
So let's take one fatality from a firearm. What does it matter when we're calculating the cost of that death? And again, we are talking about the loss of human life, and we don't want to be dismissive in any way, shape, or form. But at this point, we're just trying to get to the cost to America as a society. So is there a difference when someone passes away because they've been shot for whatever reason? Is there a difference between whether that was an accidental death when it comes to cost or a homicide?
Yes, there is. And homicides are more expensive than suicides, because suicides tend to be an older population, so they lose less years of life. The unintentional injuries and fatalities are about the same cost as a homicide, perhaps a little bit less, again, because of age differences. But you see a lot of kids in the unintentional. But unintentional, only 3% of the deaths. Like, the deaths are about equally split between homicides and suicides, and that's almost all of them.
What do we learn when you're calculating these costs? What do we learn from that? How does that help us understand gun violence better?
It gives us a way to communicate clearly the severity of these injuries. When I tell you that the costs of gun violence are more than 1.5 times the cost of drunk driving, I think that gives you a different grasp of the problem.
And in comparison with the rest of the world, the United States numbers are significantly higher?
The United States numbers look like the numbers in countries with wars going on.
Okay, so when you are calculating the, I mean, how, let me just ask you this. How do you survive? How do you keep your own anxiety at a manageable level when your work is calculating the cost of gun violence?
Well, my work is calculating the costs of injury and the costs of substance abuse and the savings from prevention. What's frustrating with gun violence is that the Congress stopped the research on how to prevent it and how to prevent those deaths. And so it's frustrating not to be able to say, and here's what we can save if we do this, this, and this, the way we would with other injuries.
I assume you're referring to the point in time when they removed funding for the CDC to be able to spend anything on the research into gun violence, correct?
That's correct.
So what difference does that make for, as a researcher, how does that make guns different then as an industry from, say, the tobacco industry, which we, most of us are well aware, they were sued for the costs of cigarette use. Can that not be done with guns?
Congress also passed the law saying that you can't sue the firearm injury because somebody was killed with a firearm. They gave them a shield that they've given no other industry. The research on the death toll and the toll of smoking largely came from the Department of Health and Human Services. Art Kellerman, who was a doc in Georgia, was funded by CDC, the study that Mark Rosenberg was citing about you being more likely to die in your home if you have a firearm than if you don't.
Yeah.
Was Art Kellerman's work, and that's some of the work that they stopped. And it was done down in Georgia.
We're talking about the costs of gun violence. I'm speaking with Ted Miller. He's a health economist at the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, and his work continues. Ted, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's hear another comment. And again, we welcome your comments. Guns are dividing Americans in a way that almost no other subject does. In fact, at this point, some polls show that the only thing that divides Americans more firmly than guns is a wall between the United States and Mexico. Here's a comment again from Milledgeville. This is Vincent Smith.
A nephew of mine, he was at a car wash up in Atlanta. Someone stole his car and a gunfight occurred, and he was shot several times. But, you know, he survived. It happens so much that we get kind of destabilized and we don't think about it, not unless it directly affects us.
I want to bring into the conversation Ben Hallman, who's deputy editor for The Trace, and they focus a lot of their works on firearms. Ben, good morning.
Good morning.
One of the things that has to be frustrating for you is the lack of accurate reporting on firearms. Why is it so difficult to get the facts straight on this subject?
Well, there's a few different ways that journalists, I'd say, get it wrong. And just want to preface this with there's a lot of great reporting that we read and learn from journalists across America on this subject. So this is not a blanket statement. However, we do see frequent mistakes in terms of how reporters identify how guns work they can seem like little things, I think, to the casual reader. Maybe confusing a magazine and a clip, for example. The magazine is what you load into a gun to hold multiple bullets and multiple cartridges, and a clip is sometimes within a magazine. It's also a term for an older style of feeding bullets into a gun. Anyway, that sounds super technical and not interesting, probably, but
it does matter.
These little mistakes do matter. Assault. We see journalists refer to the AR-15 type of weapon as an assault rifle. The U.S. military says,
style.
Assault style. Well, the U.S. military says the assault rifle has the ability to switch to automatic fire, shoot bursts of bullets by holding down the gun. So these seem like little things, but to the gun owners out there who are especially sensitive to how journalists cover the thing that they care about a lot, they use that and tune you out.
Right, exactly. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. Ben Hallman is deputy editor for The Trace. We are talking about gun violence today. Join the conversation. This is on Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. All this hour, we focus on firearms in the South, and there is so much more. More reporting, more information, more things to see and hear online. You can read about how mass shootings are tracked, which ones have happened in Georgia, and see a list of our state's current gun laws. It's all at our website, gpbnews.org. As I mentioned, Americans are more divided on the issues of guns than we are on abortion, marijuana, even same-sex marriage. Why? Some say the media is largely responsible for promoting guns, both pro and anti-gun values. Others claim politicians play on our emotions in order to fire up passions on these issues. But why are guns such an emotional issue for Americans? With me now is Catherine White, professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning.
And we bring back Ben Hallman, deputy editor for The Trace. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
I want to play for you a comment, Catherine, from Emma Phillips. She's speaking here with BBC News.
We've been brought up this way. We've been taught you have a gun, you go hunt animals, and you feed the family. And I think if that's taken away from us as Americans, we lose that sense of self almost, because we've been raised to take care of our families.
How does gun ownership become connected with sense of self?
Well, I think certainly something that we see is that it can become very deeply ingrained in your cultural values. So one thing that I've been thinking about surrounding this issue is that if you look at the South in particular, there's a culture that's called an honor culture. And particularly among men in an honor culture, what you have is there's a heavy emphasis placed on maintaining a reputation, and that you should be willing to defend that reputation violently if necessary, and with aggression, and that's kind of expected and accepted. And the important thing for the reputation is that people don't feel like they can cross you, that they can't take advantage of you, that they can't hurt you. And so one thing that I can certainly see is that owning a gun would be a really easy way to ensure that you are able to protect that reputation, and that you are able to protect your family and yourself and to maintain your independence. And this is a culture that's been in place for a long time. This goes back to the beginning of the nation. And so this is something that becomes very deeply ingrained in the culture itself.
Generational. It's part of your family.
Generational. Absolutely.
Heritage.
Absolutely.
So, Ben, this becomes an issue for journalists like you and me. I had a discussion with somebody in which he was saying, my gun makes me safer in my home. And I said, statistically, that's not true. And he says, well, I don't believe statistics. How do you, as a journalist who for whom this issue is what you cover, how do you deal with sort of the emotions that sometimes make facts to some irrelevant?
Well, I do think, and what I was saying earlier, I do think there's maybe a heightened sensitivity among gun owners, many gun owners who think that journalists don't get it or are reflexively anti-gun. I think one of the things we can do as journalists is recognize that gun owners are not a monolithic group. Mm-hmm. They're liberals, they're Democrats who own guns, and a large majority of them, based on polling, do actually support some types of gun control measures like universal background checks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the fear of as one of the the soundbite said the woman who said that someone taking away your gun. I mean, that is a real fear, and it is one that is being, I would say, amped up maybe by the gun lobby. But that also isn't a real proposal that's on the table.
And I've never seen, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've never seen an actual bill proposed to take away guns in the U.S.
Well, you know, the so-called assault weapons ban absolutely not. No one has proposed that. So I think, you know, to your original question, people, you know, I think we shouldn't dismiss people's honest fears of becoming a victim of violent crime. People do feel afraid, and they do want to protect their families, and some see a gun as the best way to do that, especially people who might live in a rural area or are far away from police. So, you know, I think we need to acknowledge as journalists those fears and explore those.
Here's another voice of a gun supporter, this anonymous person. He's a man who spoke with The Guardian talking about why the United States needs guns.
It is the great equalizer. If two people have a gun, they're equal. Or whoever has the gun, they are supreme. Every time they pass another gun control law, they promise us safety. Do you know who did the same thing? Adolf Hitler.
So, Catherine, you're making but this is, you know, when you have fear involved, and as Ben mentioned, sometimes that's an absolutely honest, sincere fear, that makes us, what? Let me ask you. That puts us into what state of mind when our fears are triggered? What does that do to us psychologically?
Well, psychologically, it makes it a lot harder to make rational decisions. So what we clearly see from the research is that if we are relying on our emotions, particularly if we are trying to assess risk levels, we tend to use kind of these cognitive shortcuts that lead us to make inaccurate decisions.
Is cognitive shortcut like a gut feeling?
It's like an intuition, absolutely, a quick decision, snap decision. And we have entire industries based on, if we were good at risk assessment, we wouldn't have entire industries based on risk assessment. We're not very good at it,
right,
when we just kind of sit down to it.
There'd be no insurance adjusters.
Exactly. And so I think the gun industry, and in particular, has been very good at recognizing this. So if you look at the actual advertising and lobbying efforts, it's geared towards evoking a fear. And then providing, it's most persuasive if you can evoke a fear, and then you can provide a solution. So essentially, if you look at the actual advertisements that take place, you know, you've got a woman who's home alone, somebody's trying to bang down the door, very strong fear. This is a fear many women have. Provide a handy solution. You have a gun. You can protect yourself. That's an extremely effective persuasive technique. The research supports that. And I think when it comes to why do people not listen to statistics, because evolutionarily we have evolved to listen to emotion than we have more to statistics. And so in terms of the persuasive appeals and efforts, hands down, emotion is going to win more in this battle, simply because that's how our brain works.
Not just on guns. I mean,
no.
Anything. That's nonpartisan.
It's across the board.
Yeah, that's nonpartisan. That's Catherine White, professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University. We're also speaking to Ben Hallman, who's deputy editor for The Trace. That's a nonprofit journalism outfit devotes itself to issues surrounding firearms. Ben, when we're talking about guns as an emotional issue, which again could be related to almost any issue that we face as Americans, what could we learn if we were to open up the research floodgates on guns? What kind of questions do you want answered?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, there is research on guns. It's just not a lot of it's being federally supported at this point.
Yeah.
You know, in the last part of the discussion, I was thinking about a study that just came out that was focused on the people who carry guns every day. Concealed carry holders, people who, when they leave the house, they bring a gun with them, right? And so the estimate is that about 3 million people fit that demographic. And it's just a really interesting group. It skews Southern, skews white, skews Republican, skews male, skews towards people who grew up with guns in their family. And here's the really interesting thing, and we're going back to the issue of fear. It also skews heavily towards people who actually are the least likely to become victims of crime.
Huh. We have a tweet here from Steve Brown who says, guns, approximately 270 million civilian guns, 200,000 a year women use a gun to defend themselves. I don't have the fact check in front of me, Steve. That seems like a really surprisingly high number, so I'm going to have to look into that. As always, you can add your voice to this discussion. You can tweet us like Steve did at OST Talk or give us a call at 404-500-9457. Let's address another issue, and that's the mass shooters and how much we talk about them personally. Here's Governor Mike Huckabee on CNN, and he's talking about a shooting at a community college in Oregon.
It's pretty apparent from the postings online that this shooter wanted to be famous. Who makes him famous? Well, frankly, it's all of the television networks that go 24/7 putting up his name and his face.
Now, here is Danielle Belton with a response to that. She is with The Root, and she spoke with NPR about how that's easier said than done.
I feel like you can't avoid it. I mean, someone's going to write about it. Someone's going to talk about it. As long as there's a hunger in the public for this information, it's going to come out. You'd have to change the entire American society's feelings about celebrity culture, infamy, and crime to get people to not want to talk about this.
I want to emphasize that we are changing tacks here. When we talk about mass shooters, that is not your average gun owner by any stretch of the imagination. But Catherine, what is the psychological impression that you make on someone when you do spend a lot of time talking about the life and the personality of a mass shooter?
Well, I think certainly the more you're exposed to information, the more kind of deeply ingrained it gets. So I think the more you talk about these things, what essentially happens is there's been some interesting research that has said, okay, for people who actually watch more news and things of that sort, do they generally feel like the world is a more dangerous place? And the answer is yes. And so I think essentially what we're seeing in the media is when we cover a lot of these events, when we cover a lot of the violence that's going on, it's important. People need to know that these things are happening, but at the same time, it can create an inflated sense that the world is a dangerous place and that these things are maybe more likely to occur than not. I don't know that that necessarily applies to mass shootings, though, because those have been going up in frequency and so forth, to the point that now there's interesting research that says that people buy more guns after a mass shooting. But this last time, it didn't actually go up because I think people are essentially getting to a point where they're like, meh, it happened again. And the market is maybe saturated. And so I think there's something to be said for not wanting to kind of glorify these particular actions or the individuals that perpetuate them. But it's a fine line to walk, and I'm not sure that this necessarily applies to mass shooters.
We just don't know enough. In the minute that we have left, Ben, can you get us clear on the crime statistics? Because we have statistics from the FBI saying crime on the whole is going down, but we hear a ton of people talking about rising in violent crime. Why don't we know the answer on this?
Yeah, well, we know some answers. I mean, so let's just state this for everybody who's listening. Violent crime in America is down by half. It is half what it was in the 90s. So the average American is significantly less likely to become a victim of violent crime than they used to be. And that's a huge change. However, we've seen the last few years, violent crime rates have been ticking back up. And in some urban places in America, some major American cities, and even mid-sized American cities, the rates didn't go down that much to begin with, and they remain very high, and they remain at levels that you would expect to see in a place like Honduras. Yeah. So it really depends again on who you are in America. Your risk of becoming a gun violence victim is highly dependent on who you are, where you grew up.
That is Ben Hallman. He's deputy editor for The Trace. Catherine White is professor of psychology at Kennesaw State University. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amid the barrage of news stories about gun violence, there are real people whose lives are torn apart by tragedy, like Samaje Clarke. 2 years ago, he was paralyzed after being shot in Savannah. Now he's confined to a wheelchair. Before becoming an anti-gun violence advocate, Samaje was involved in gang activity, and he says the media has a certain responsibility when they cover shootings.
My name is Samaje Clarke, and I'm currently based in Los Angeles, California. I was out in Savannah for about 17 months. Being shot is like it's a crazy experience. I was shot 3 times when I was 15 in my own neighborhood. I was shot another time when I was 16, and I got shot 3 times in Savannah, Georgia, just going out there to go do a speech. The first time I got shot, it felt like hot iron going through my skin. And the third time I got shot, it was crazy. I just felt like a massive thump hit my spine, and I just felt my legs go out. I hit the floor. I tried to get up, and I couldn't get up. I was in group homes, foster homes, and I was exposed to a lot growing up. So at an early age, my mind was on a different level than other kids. So I just started to hang with other people. I started to hang with older people, and I started to get in trouble. I was involved in gang violence, but it wasn't what I thought it was. You know, like in the end, I found out, you know, that the streets really, you know, they don't love nobody, and it's really nothing out there for you, and that's really the message that I push now to the youth, because like, yeah, I went looking in the streets, but I didn't really found nothing. And when the time came down to it, I didn't really have nobody who had my back. So
we start with more violence tonight in East Savannah. Metro Police say 3 people were shot near East 55th and Cedar Streets.
A man is on the run tonight after allegedly shooting another man this evening in West Macon.
When I see news coverage, I feel like they shouldn't identify people as gangsters or thugs or hoodlums, you know, because that just makes it look crazy on the other end to the people who are viewing it and the people who have never been in that area. A problem I have with the news coverage is they make it seem like that we're putting the guns in our community. Like, yeah, it just makes me feel like, you know, they look at us like we're monsters or something, like we're just animals. I think they should know what they're saying, or know who they're calling a thug, or know who they're calling a super predator or gangster, or just like identify who they're talking about. I think I lost probably like 12 or 13 friends to gun violence. Yeah, every time I look up in the sky, I see one of my friends or one of my homies, you know, telling me good job or watch out, you know, don't do that. You know, like they keep me going. They keep me on the right path.
That story was produced by GPB's Sean Powers. And that's our show for today. But we'd love to hear from you, as we've heard from so many people this hour.
This is Owen Scarpness from Atlanta, Georgia. I am a gun owner that thinks that we should have stricter gun laws, because I mean, these are weapons that are capable of such vast destruction, and yet you don't have to pass a test. You don't have to have any kind of training or knowledge about safety.
What do you think should be done? What do you think could be done to curb gun violence? Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also reach us on Twitter or Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.